KZSU-FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an associate professor at Elon University School of Law, as well as an affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet Society at Stanford Law School. And beginning in August of this year, a visiting research collaborator at Princeton's Center for Information Technology Policy. Thank you for joining me today on the show. Today I'm excited to have on David Zweig, author of the new book Invisibles, The Power of Anonymous Work in an Age of Relentless Self-Promotion. So, I don't know where to go from there with that introduction, because I feel like anything I say now will either make me or not make me an invisible. But in David's book, what he does is discuss in a good amount of depth this concept of the invisible. And the invisible is someone that I'm going to ask David to define for us. But basically, it is someone who does work not for the recognition, but for the value of the work itself. Now, whether those individuals actually eschew recognition is something else entirely, and we'll talk about it. But in David's book, this subtitle, Anonymous Work in the Age of Relentless Self-Promotion, is effectively a series of biographies of people whose work you know but don't realize you know it. So the engineer who was able to get the quintessential Led Zeppelin sound in classics like When the Levee Breaks, the people that set lighting a certain way that works on stage, or individuals that create a system so that you can walk through an airport and not get lost. All of these people are names that, and David writes biographies and short biographies of them in the book, are people that are known well within their industry, but are probably not known to anyone else. And so that is your invisible. And in the book, David takes a close look at that concept, but also takes a look at what kind of theoretical and practical bases there are for identifying the traits of these people and what they contribute to society. And so there's a lot going on in the book built around these lengthy biographies of a number of these individuals. As I was, thinking about having David on the show to talk about this book, and thinking about Hearsay Culture from a very early point in the beginning of the show, and I didn't take a look back at the schedule, but it has to be going, perhaps into the shows that were maybe around number 20 or number 25. I've had people on talking about what social media is and what reputation is. Eric Davis was on as one of the early guests talking about his writing involving Led Zeppelin IV and the study of Led Zeppelin IV. Now, this is not a book about music, although David is also a musician, but there's a lot of the creative arts that play through these stories, or perhaps there's something about the creative arts that creates the atmosphere where we might see invisibles. But there's also issues involving reputation itself. Vance Ricks, a professor at Guilford College here in Greensboro, was on the show not too long ago discussing his work on what reputation means online. And of course, we've had a whole range of discussions from Eric Davis to Vance Ricks involving questions of reputation, trademark, privacy, socialization, interaction, communication, and so forth. In Invisibles, David brings a lot of these concepts together to draw these again, fact-based vignettes about these individuals and what they mean in society. So it's a really fun and interesting read. And in fact, one of the compliments, it's a rare compliment, but it happens, is there's a couple of pages in the book that I actually took a look at and thought maybe I should photocopy them and put them up on my screen when I'm trying to get work done. What do I mean, for example, and I'll point it out here in the introduction, towards the middle of the book, in a chapter entitled Flow and the Power of Expertise with Effort, David talks about this concept of flow, which as he defines it, is a mental state that occurs when a person is completely immersed in an activity where the ego falls away, and he's quoting another scholar, the ego falls away, time flies, and every action, movement, and thought follows inevitably from the previous one. And in the book, David talks about how flow is one of the things or one of the traits that invisibles tend to lock into, and the joy of being in that state. And as someone who, like many people, is juggling a number of tasks at any given time, the idea of getting back to the concept of flow and finding that in my own work is something very enticing. But there's a lot of other ideas here and other concepts that we're going to talk about today on the show, and we are recording Sunday night, July 13th, and David is joining us via Skype from his home in Brooklyn. By way of very brief background, David's written for The Atlantic, The New York Times, and The Wall Street Journal. His novel, Swimming Inside the Sun, received great reviews when it came out. He's a singer, guitar player, and producer. He's released a couple of albums, which I don't do a lot of music reviews here, but good to know, and I'll look it up. He's presented his research about how media technology affects self-perception in academic conferences and universities. And as I mentioned, he lives in Brooklyn with his wife and two kids. David, thank you for joining us this evening on Hearsay Culture.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start off, David, with a question I ask most of my authors. Tell us a bit more about your background and why you chose to write Invisibles.
Well, many years ago, I worked as a magazine fact checker. I was predominantly at Condé Nast and a number of their magazines, and though the majority of my time was spent at the fashion Bible Vogue. And the thing about working as a magazine fact checker is that the better you do that job, the more you disappear. And I just found this to be really strange because in our culture, for most of us, the better we do our work, the more recognition we receive. Yet in that role, if I did my job perfectly, no one would ever think of me. The line I like to give is, when's the last time you read a great magazine article and thought to yourself, man, this was fact-checked beautifully? you know, the answer, of course, is never.
Right.
And the odd thing was that I found myself feeling really rewarded oftentimes at the end of the day. This is pretty tedious work, oftentimes required a really long hours of just being super focused on a lot of minutia, but I would find myself in the flow state, as you described in the introduction, and you know, I'd come home and I just thought, wow, this is so strange. How is it that I can feel really rewarded even though no one knows that I'm doing a good job? You know, this really seems to be the opposite of the message at large of our culture, where we're told basically that to feel good, you need to be recognized. That's like one of these sort of what we take as a really almost like a basic instinctual component of our humanity, is that being recognized and noticed feels good. And then kind of a second prong to that we're, you know, the message seems to be that in order to become successful, that you really need to make yourself known. And that, so I just found this to be, wow, this is really odd. I enjoy this work, yet no one knows that I'm doing a good job. And I just wanted to kind of start to dissect that a little bit more. And I just began to think over time, well, what other jobs, if there are any, share this same sort of inverse relationship between work and recognition? Not all of them maybe have this notion of the better they do their job, the more they disappear. Though most of them do, the jobs that I ended up, and the professions that I ended up looking into. But I wanted to figure out, in a culture where attention is valued so highly, what kind of person chooses to work behind the scenes and thrives there? So one of the first professions I thought of were anesthesiologists. Now, of course, we all are familiar with anesthesiology, so it's not that they're hidden, although some of the professionals in my book are really invisible. I mean, it's unlikely that you know, the average public's going to be aware of the work they do, and those were a lot of fun to write about and to learn about. But there are other ones like anesthesiologists that we all know about, but the thing about an anesthesiologist is that, like the fact checker, the better they do their job, the less notice they get. In fact, if they do their job perfectly, they're invisible. So, you know, one of the guys who I interviewed for the book, this great line, one of the anesthesiologists, he said, listen, if you want to get the fruit baskets sent to you from patients, you don't go into anesthesiology. So I wanted to just try to start to deconstruct, well, what is it? Why is it there's a guy, you know, who is in the book, who Ivy League educated, he's at a top university hospital, he's out in California, super bright. He could have gone into any number of specialties within medicine where he'd really be getting a lot of praise and kudos from his patients. Yet, and as a matter of fact, he could have gone into even outside of medicine. This is someone who's very capable. Just a quick side note. The people in this book are not invisibles in the notion of kind of the factory worker toiling away anonymously in a third world country, or the, you know, hotel worker who's cleaning your room. Those people are important and they need to be valued. But those weren't the people I was interested in exploring for the book. I really wanted people who were really capable, highly skilled professionals whose work was critical to whatever endeavor they were a part of, but yet who went largely unnoticed by the public. And I wanted to just find out, well, what professions are there, and what, if anything, about these people did they have in common? What made them tick, and what made them so successful? And that was sort of the impetus for the book. And that was a number of years ago. And then I slowly shifted from working as a fact checker into being a writer. I was doing a lot of journalism, and I wrote an article for The Atlantic called "What Do Fact Checkers and Anesthesiologists Have in Common?" which was really the launch point for the book. I was very fortunate. There was a lot of excitement and interest around the piece among people within the publishing industry. And here we are a few years after.
So we've got, David, you know, the classic first question they ask is, okay, what's an invisible? Now, obviously, that's a question that you could answer in the next 40 minutes. So let me ask you, with regard to those three traits that you identify early on in the book. So what are the three traits of an invisible? And in that way, we can begin to define what you mean by the term.
Sure. Well, as I mentioned, you know, in my previous answer, you know, invisibles are, you know, kind of a real nutshell definition is, again, this person who's a highly skilled professional whose work is critical to whatever larger enterprise they're a part of, but who go largely unnoticed by the public or the end user, be it the patient, the reader, the whoever it is, whatever the end user is of the enterprise they're a part of. So, and I found, despite an incredibly disparate range of fields and industries that these people work in, who I interviewed and met with at their job sites, that I found, despite this incredibly wide range, that they all shared certain traits. And the first and sort of most obvious and prominent one is an ambivalence toward recognition. They just simply don't seek attention the way it seems so many of us do in our culture. The second trait is that they all tend to be meticulous. And it's funny, they all use that word, meticulous, with me when I was interviewing and talking with them, but more so than their own reportage on their own selves was witnessing it, you know. And I really try to take you in the book, I really try to bring you into these people's work lives. So you don't need to even take their word for it. I want you to experience this really just profound meticulousness in a real way when you see the work they do. And that too, just like an ambivalence toward recognition, I think runs really counter to the prevailing ethos today. I make a pretty extended argument as well that meticulousness, I think to a large degree for a lot of the population, also runs against the norm today. And then the last trait core trait that they all tend to share is what I call they savor responsibility. And that, you know, and I would argue again that too is something that's a bit antithetical to the larger population today, that most people seem to want to avoid responsibility. It's seen as a burden. But for these people, by and large, they really wanted responsibility. They really reveled in the power that came with this responsibility, even though their responsibility was largely unseen. And in some ways, I think that's the most, the purest sense of someone who's responsible, someone who knows that no one's going to get credit for it, that they won't be known for being in charge of X, Y, or Z, but that they still want that role. That, to me, is there's something really beautiful and powerful about that.
So we're chatting with David Zweig, author of the book Invisibles, The Power of Anonymous Work in an Age of Relentless Self-Promotion, published by Penguin. So this subtitle, David, is a fairly provocative one, I'm sure intentionally. And, you know, I want to focus on the phrase relentless self-promotion. Because when I looked at the cover, right, I mean, you know, and you know, the cover is, I don't want to get into how books are marketed, right, but obviously you want to catch people's attention. When I look at relentless self-promotion, when I see that phrase, and that's a phrase, incidentally, that you will see used with some frequency, even in academic listservs, where people will say, you know, self-promotion alert, or, you know, apologies for self-promotion, and immediately promote themselves. And I guess there's something to be said for being aware of the fact that you're doing it. On the other hand, maybe it's too cute by half because, you know, if you really didn't want to promote or you were ashamed of it, you wouldn't do it. But here's my question, right, with that context. Are you making in this book a judgment call or a good and bad call on your assessment that we are in an age of relentless self-promotion? What is your view of relentless self-promotion as a societal good or a societal bad, or are you ambivalent or neutral on that question?
Well, I think I make a pretty persuasive case throughout the book, and through this, through these long form profiles of these invisibles themselves, about, as the subtitle says, the power of anonymous work in an age of relentless self-promotion. So I think they make the case for me, rather than me trying to tell you whether, you know, too much promotion is good or bad. I let these people who are incredibly successful and yet also very fulfilled, yet really revel in their behind the scenes role. I think they make the case themselves about, you know, the larger culture. With that said, you know, I also, in a central chapter in the book that's not one of the profile chapters, but where I get into a bit of just kind of the meat of my larger premise, is that indeed, I think there is what I talk about in the book is that there's always been this, what I view as a real duality in American culture, and a duality that's brought the culture by and large a lot of success, where on the one hand we have this kind of puritanical nose to the grindstone, just kind of this silent worker mentality that's been with us, you know, from the origins of the country. David Foster Wallace, I think, you know, referred to this as the quiet dignity of the average American. You can think of the company man of the last century. And that was really balanced with what I call our American noise, this sort of the Hollywood Klieg lights reaching to the world. You think of, you know, the robber barons, and not just Cornelius not just their, you know, gilded mansions, but Cornelius Vanderbilt's wild sideburns. Just this, you know, hip hop's bling, Elvis's, you know, swinging hips. So these two things together are, I argue, is what has brought us a lot of our prosperity. But what I argue today, and I think there's a lot of examples I get into in the book, is that we are now in a time where that balance has become a little bit out of whack, where the quiet dignity of the average American, I think, is being drowned out by the noise today. And I think that's really both to a societal, economic, and what I'm particularly interested in, personal detriment, that we are now being overly focused on our noise, on promotion, and there's not enough respect for and emphasis on the sort of quiet dignity of just doing good work and the value that comes from that.
So, David, let me, with that framing of this issue of promotion, let's talk about a few of those examples that you use before we get into the broader, societal implications, which I do want to discuss, and which you do, you know, you kind of intersperse, throughout the book, these citations to other work and analysis. You bookend the book, with the story involved, and again, these are all factual, the story involving, right, this, producer of Zeppelin's, famous albums, right? And you discuss his work, throughout the book. You begin and end with the work that, Johns did. And what struck me immediately, gets at this question of what exactly is meant by an invisible, right? Because you describe, Johns, this producer, engineer, right, hanging out with only the most, you know, well-known rock band, probably, you know, second to the Beatles, depending on how you classify them, right? But certainly, you know, one of the two or three biggest bands in the history of rock, right? And he's right there with them. And so it's hard to imagine that person as an individual, particularly as their work, right, is on very famous rock recordings. And as you dig into these issues, and I want to use this as an example, the definition of an invisible, I think, turns more on these questions of why someone is recognized for their work as opposed to how or what they do to promote themselves. So Johns is identified as the guy who came up with the ways you talk about to set the microphones and get that sound, as opposed to the guy who was at the parties. Now, I'm being loose here because you don't say that. I'm saying it. But I want to get your reaction to that. Right? Is when we're talking about an invisible, are we really talking about a person where you're focusing on the why you do the work, or is there something else to it?
Well, you know, ultimately, what I on the journey of researching, writing the book, and I bring the reader on this journey, that ultimately it's really not even about whether you're invisible or not, you know, how much you're seen or not seen. It's really about what motivates you. And that, so the people I focus on the book indeed are invisibles by and large. But what I found is that even some of the most famous people among us, still embody some of these quote invisible traits. So that, and that by embodying these traits, that led a lot of these people to their success, and that, you know, fame was really just a byproduct, if you will, of a different driver for them that, you know, in the example I give, you could think about, you know, the star quarterback who's silently studying game film, you know, for 5-6 nights a week before the big game on Sunday. Or you could think of the overnight sensation pop star who actually had been playing dive bars for a decade, you know, before, the big break. So in the end, perhaps focusing on how much someone is seen or not seen really isn't the thing that becomes the most fascinating. The thing that's the most interesting is what kind of traits seems to lead people both towards success and also toward a very deep fulfillment in their work. And what are those traits? And it turns out that a lot of these people who have these traits happen to be invisibles, but one need not be, quote, invisible in order to embody these traits. It's not an exclusive club here. This is really people who are just operate at the far end of a spectrum we all fall upon.
So, David, is the biographies that you write and cover in the book, is there an individual or a story that, in your estimation, is one where the ability to become or continue to be an invisible is most challenged? And the reason why I ask that question, as we're going to get into, is I'm curious about what you see as the societal forces that push against invisibility as you defined it. So is there someone who has struggled, from what you can tell, in maintaining their invisibility, assuming that they desire it in the first place?
Hmm. You know, all the people in the book who I focus on, who are really none of them struggled with their invisible role. I think, you know, and I think that that is why they became so successful, is that they, the people who do behind the scenes work or just part of organizations or larger endeavors, but who feel really, resentful that they're not more noticed for the work, that they're not more widely seen or thought of by the public. Those are the people, I think, by and large, who really don't make it to the top, you know, so to speak. So I think there's something there in the fact that these people, now again, invisibles really can run across the full strata, you know, of the quote, like the success range from people at the top of the rung to people in the middle and everywhere in between, and whether it's, you know, entrepreneurs, people who work by themselves, people part of very large organizations. So, but the people I wanted to choose for the book were people who really were at the top of their fields, because I was curious to see, well, what, if anything, as we sort of deconstruct things and look backwards, what, if anything, connected all them together? If that sort of answers your question.
I think it does in part, and maybe let me ask it a little more specifically, because what I'm really curious about is what societal forces exist that push against the ability of one of your invisibles to maintain their invisibility. In other words, are there? Let me give a better example of this and put it this way. Right? There are people who are in professions that, by virtue of the profession, they must promote themselves. Right? I mean, I don't want to be snarky with the question, so it's not my intention. Right? But of course, I'm sure you're hearing this from others. Right? There is an irony. Right? That here we are discussing your book. Right? That you want to sell, right? And I'm all for selling books, and I'm particularly for bringing on interesting and valuable work on the show, which is why you're here, right? But you, by virtue of being an author, right, have to, at some level, right, market your book, right? I mean, you know, Penguin is not in this for altruistic reasons, right? And so, there's a situation where, and I'm not, I don't, again, to be clear, David, I'm not painting you in a corner, I'm just using it as an example, right? You've got a situation where I can imagine people who choose, right, to exemplify the traits you have identified, and who yet cannot be, right, divorced from self-promotion, cannot be as meticulous as they would like to be. Or as I mentioned in my introduction, I'd love to be in that flow state more often than I am. So I'm curious if you did answer part of my question, but I want to probe a little more deeply and ask you if there are any of these invisibles who struggle with that. Before I ask you really the follow-up question after the break, which will be, you know, what do you see as the societal forces that make it difficult for one to be an invisible? So let's start with anyone, if there is anyone, who comes to mind that would meet that challenge.
Got it. It's a great question. Thanks for kind of clarifying it there a little bit. Now I know where you're coming from. Yeah, I'm going to go back and say again, the people who I really focused on, none of them really struggled with this notion. And I think that's part of the reason why they got to where they are. It's a bit counterintuitive, and I cite a fair amount of academic research from people from Wharton and other business schools and stuff. There's just a ton of research in that space on success and leadership and stuff like that. That really, it's a bit counterintuitive, but supports the notion that people who really are ambivalent toward recognition or are ambivalent or, you know, really outright against doing a lot of self-promotion, that actually a lot of those people end up at the top of what field they're in. Now, with that said, there's nothing wrong, let me make this clear, despite the subtitle of the book, there's nothing wrong with promoting ourselves and our work. We all need to do that at different times and in different circumstances. The invisibles are not meek. It's not someone who's hiding in the corner somewhere. All the people who I profile in the book, you know, all, when they need to be, have been assertive in their, you know, career paths. And, you know, these are not people who are walked upon. Being an invisible, as I define it here, and these people, it's not about being someone who's taken advantage of all the time. These people are very confident. They're very ambitious, but they manage to marry this humility that they have in this kind of very self-effacing manner with this ambition and confidence. And it's just this, I think, a very powerful and a very unusual hybrid of traits to marry together. But there is this pressure, and I won't get into it if you want me to kind of get into it as the second part here.
Oh, yeah, go, no, if you want to take it up now, go ahead, that's fine.
Okay, so the thing is, there is both a larger societal pressure, and then certainly within, you know, pretty much every industry in the business culture, and I'm sure in academia as well, and basically every field of endeavor, there is this norm that has been developed today where we are all expected to push on that. And a great example is, you know, when we were, my agent and I were shopping the book around, there were a number of publishers who were interested. I had a meeting with an editor at one of the publishing houses who, you know, was interested in the book, and she said, you know, I just really identify with what you're talking about. She said, recently my boss told me that I should need to start a Twitter account, and I need to really just raise my profile online and start doing more stuff. And she said, I'm an editor, for God's sake. My whole role is to be behind the scenes. Why do I need to do that? And I thought this was just this amazing example. And I was like, ooh, I'm on the right track here with selling this book. This is great. I'm like, because I was like, what a great example of what's gone wrong here, this notion of promotion run amok. So wait, there are certain professions, the people who are really out front. Listen, I'm a writer. My name is on the cover of my books. I have my name in my bylines, and I'm happy to have it there. It's great. There's nothing wrong with feeling good about gaining some recognition for yourself from time to time. And there's nothing wrong with promoting yourself. I'm here doing the show with you right now. The reality is, you know, I also spent about 2 years alone basically working on this book, and I'm going to spend about 2 months promoting it. That seems like a reasonable ratio to me. But most of us, the larger pressure is that we have to have this sort of, whether it's a lot of it has to do with social media, with this sort of online profile we're supposed to have where you need to like build a platform and all this stuff, or even outside of social media, just the expectations in your work environment where everyone's kind of like this norm of CCing your boss and everyone else, you know, every time you send an email that's touting your accomplishments and things of that nature. So there's these cultural norms that are being built up today where things are expected of us. And more often than not, I make the case in the book, more often than not, it's really counterproductive for most of us to be spending as much time as we do on promotion. That one of the guys who I quote in the book, it was freelance writer. He's written for The Atlantic and a number of other prestigious publications. And he said, you know, for a while, he bought into this notion because this is really pervasive in the culture and particularly in the media field where you need to, quote, get your name out there as a writer if that's what you're doing. And he said he spent a long time trying to build up a Twitter following, and he was pretty successful at it. But then he realized something. He said, what I ultimately learned was after spending a couple years building up, you know, thousands of followers, he said, having a lot of followers doesn't get you good work. Good work gets you a lot of followers. And I think that really applies to everyone, you know, no matter what we're doing. It's heartening and encouraging, but the evidence seems to show, both from all these examples of people I profile in the book and also from a wealth of business literature, academic setting on this, that good work, as long as you're not, you know, someone who's going to be a doormat, but good work gets recognized in the end. And that's something that I think we are afraid that that's not the case. You know, we're afraid, we feel like we need to be doing this, but what the evidence seems to show is that people who spend their time working, this guy, the Joel Keller, the freelance writer I just mentioned, you know, he said, what I found was instead of burning hour and hour and hour working on building up my Twitter following, instead I could have been writing articles. I could have been researching stuff. I could have been pitching editors. And when I started doing that, then I started becoming more successful. That we're just, there's nothing wrong with promoting ourselves, but that the ratio is completely out of balance about what we think we need to do. And there are all these marketing gurus and people telling us that we need to be doing all this stuff, and it's a myth.
We're chatting with David Zweig, author of the book Invisibles, The Power of Anonymous Work in an Age of Relentless Self-Promotion. And here we go on KZSU FM Stanford. Here I'm going to go. I'm going to promote KZSU, but I'm going to ask for money for a non-profit, non-commercial radio station that is at Stanford University and requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways to listen to the show, and you have a couple of ways to make a donation. You could email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. And incidentally, if you want another group of invisibles, check with underwriters. Or you can go to our webpage at kzsu.stanford.edu and click on Donate to KZSU. Regardless, I hope that you continue to listen to the show. So I was curious about this as well, David. You started getting to it, and again, you know, this is a show where I ask, I try to ask probing questions, but I also ask questions that I know take a little bit of time. And so here's another one for you, and it's another definitional question, because as I was reading the book, I was trying to see if I could draw the line between self-promotion and recognition, right? Because all of your, as you pointed out, you know, and as I pointed out, I mean, all of your invisibles receive recognition. So if we're going to draw the line between recognition and self-promotion, what is that? Where is that line drawn?
Yeah, I mean, right. They are two different things. This notion that the people in the book are people who are very who've achieved a tremendous amount in their fields that they work in, and for that they are by and large very well regarded within their fields. They're recognized among their peers and others in the space that they work in. So it's not that there's not recognition for them. There is. It's just that the sort of dovetail of that is that these people just simply don't push and promote themselves. And there's, I think, almost a certain sort of self-selecting process here, that the type of person who goes into a field, and you think of like engineers, you know, I love it. I think a lot of the people in the book are very technical type workers. And I tend to not be a good technician. I think maybe that's why I'm so interested in them, and so admiring of what they do. But, you know, you think of like, to me, an engineer is just like the prototypical invisible, that to not be a big self-promoter often ties hand in hand with the type of person who's going to go into a field, or even regardless of the field, the type of person who's going to function in a way where ultimately they're not gaining a lot of broader recognition for what they're doing. And you know what? That's just fine with them. And the irony is that this approach is what brought them their success, and that this approach is what's brought them so much fulfillment, even though we think that we need to be doing the opposite in order to get ahead and in order to really feel satisfied.
So let's talk about social media here, which seems like, you know, it's an obvious connection, but it's an important one, right? And you alluded to it just a few minutes ago when you talked about, you know, the efforts from brand counsel and marketing people to say you have to be out there on social media and so forth. And so I want to, you know, pin you down if it's possible on this point to ask you what your view is of social media sites like Facebook and Twitter. Again, recognizing that you're not making a judgment call as to good or bad, and that you're not also taking a position that people shouldn't promote what they're doing, but rather that you're focusing on the lost appreciation to some degree of people simply working anonymously. Where do you see Facebook and Twitter fitting into this scheme? In other words, you know, aside from, yes, they want you to promote themselves or promote yourself, what do you see them as, market forces that are driving this, or are they rather simply serving a need that human beings have and want?
Yeah, I mean, you're right. I try to not get too much into in the book the notion of like, you know, wagging my finger at something. And I'm on social media myself, by the way. Again, you know, this is the nice thing about doing an interview with someone like you, that, you know, these are to some degree nuanced points. It's not a matter. It's easy to be like, social media bad, you know, promotion bad, not mm-hmm. promoting good. Mm-hmm. That's not what I'm saying. As I've mentioned a bunch of times, it's not about whether it's bad or good. It's about looking at things more from like a 30,000 foot view. And the thing that's fascinating about social media, I think, today in this lens specifically that I'm talking about, is that, listen, human beings in pretty much every culture from the beginning of time, everyone has always sought some degree of attention for themselves, and really, you know, the extreme end of that being fame. But even short of fame, people have always sought this out. And I give some examples, you know, going back to the ancient Greeks. Yeah, I talk about Homer in there, and then I talk about in Rome the gladiators that had their names spray painted on the, you know, walls of the ruins that they found. Not spray painted, you know, like etched into the stone. Perhaps they did use a type of spray paint.
Some allegory to it. Yes.
But the notion, though, is that what's different today from before is that while a peasant in, you know, medieval times perhaps may have wanted some degree of fame for him or herself, they knew that that really wasn't achievable in any real way, so they didn't try to pursue it or think about it. Today, however, with social media, there's really this notion that we can all have a degree of attention, or, you know, micro-celebrity, which is one of the kind of actual like academic terms for it, this micro celebrity. But what some of the academics I spoke with talk about, they said, you know, largely this is really an illusion, and it's kind of a cruel illusion at that, that one of them likened the notion of thinking that you're going to have this, you know, viral video on YouTube that's really going to blow up, that the likelihood of that happening is about the same as you buying a lottery ticket and winning the lottery. Yes, it's possible, but it's extraordinarily unlikely. So I think a lot of the culture is operating under this illusion of being able to gain a large degree of celebrity, and even short of celebrity, even just sort of this like micro celebrity where people have these kind of core of people who are watching them, but it's largely an illusion for most people. And that even for those where it's not, for whom it's not an illusion, that social media today really both enables and amplifies this tendency I think we all have toward wanting more recognition for ourselves. And I make the case in the book that I think there's a really big danger in that, both in, as I talked about a little bit earlier, both in kind of like lost man hours, if you will, and the time that people are spending online trying to promote themselves or their work, and then in a more psychological sense, the danger of living in that headspace of where attention is your metric of value. Because on Facebook, that is the only metric of value. That the number of likes you get, that is your sole metric of value. It is not about whether, there's no buttons other than the, you know, ridiculous binary of a thumbs up type of thing. That there is no value of like quality. That's not relevant in that space. The user interface of most social media is simply numbers. And so what happens to us psychologically over time when we spend so much time online where the primary, if not the sole metric of value, is attention? What happens to you? What, as far as like how you begin to feel about yourself and others and how we think we need to conduct ourselves as people? So that's what I make the case for in the book, is that social media just, I think, and pardon the negative tone here, but like infects, I think, the culture at large in about how we should conduct ourselves and think about ourselves, when that is the one, you know, metric of value.
We're chatting with David Zweig, author of the book Invisibles, The Power of Anonymous Work in an Age of Relentless Self-Promotion, on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. Yeah, I mean, I'm very self-conscious through this interview, David, of all the promotion I'm doing of the radio station of you. So, but I appreciate that you're not opposed to it. So let me ask you a couple of, I'm at the point in the show which I call the unfair portion of the show. And that's where I started asking you questions that you may not have time to answer adequately, and then I ask them anyway. Hence the unfair part. So, and this is a tough one, because as I was reading these biographies, and you noted it a few times, but you didn't say it explicitly, but I'm going to say it explicitly, that these people, these invisibles, oftentimes had personal lives that, to the extent you write about them, seem, let's say, not as rich as many people would like. You tell some anecdotes about one individual who hired a child, one of their children, and then when the child asked to be paid, this individual sent a bill showing all of the expenses that the parents had incurred in raising the child. And that's obviously an extreme example, but my real question is this: you know, that kind of meticulousness and stick-to-itiveness and focus on detail and working hard, you know, is one that we as a society struggle with the balancing that has become the hallmark of certainly today's working parent or parent or person with more than one responsibility. And it seemed like many of the invisibles that you profile seem like work not only became first in their life, but that all other relationships suffered. And I'm wondering whether that is a less positive attribute of invisibles. And you are in Brooklyn, so that's what we're hearing in the background.
Yes, indeed. That's a little bit of a local flavor there, local color. Couple things to unpack here with your question. The first one is, the example you gave was actually not of an invisible, but it was of Frank Lloyd Wright.
Fair enough, yeah.
In the book, the guy who, you know, made, who complained that his son, when his son wanted to be paid, gave him a bill or something for all the hours that he took care of him or something like that. So Frank Lloyd Wright, had notoriously, like, no respect for the engineers who worked for him. So I just wanted, that's the first point of fact, that your that your example is actually not of an invisible, but of a, the contrary, of a very, very famous person who took that route. You know, your question's interesting, and I really didn't find that to be the case at all. And I suppose perhaps you, this, and this is the first I've heard of this. You're the first person who's kind of saw things from this angle. I suppose maybe that's a function of the fact that the book, I purposely chose not to do these sort of like New Yorker style profile in the sense where you're digging, you know, where I'm going to talk about someone's childhood and get in and talk about their spouse. Again, these are not traditional biographies, as you were calling them, where it's about someone's life. I really want it to be almost exclusively about their work life. And for everyone, I gave background about who they are, and when it made sense, I integrated in their personal story, you know, with their spouses or their lives or their childhood, when it made sense to kind of add insight. But I wonder if the reason you got that impression was simply because these were really long profiles where instead of digging into, you know, I didn't want to be an armchair psychologist. I want to let the information speak for itself. So you're there, you know, one of the people I profile in the book is a guy named Dennis Poon, structural engineer on many of the world's tallest skyscrapers. I travel to China to meet with him at the Shanghai Tower while it's under construction. This is the second tallest building in the world. And I'm there with this guy, and I want the reader to be there with me. And I mean, it, to me, what the powerful evidence about these people is really about what they do and how they conduct themselves at work and how they feel about that work. And again, you know, there's a bit of color added in necessarily, you know, when it made sense about their lives. But I found these people to actually have, you know, which I didn't report on in the book, but they all seem to have pretty rich personal lives. So you think of this Dennis Poon, who's married, he has two children, he talked with me about his sons. One of the other people in the book is a man named Pete Clements, and he is, over the past 20 years, has been the chief guitar tech for Radiohead, you know, one of the biggest, most respected bands in the world. I met up with him and the band while they were on tour in Europe, and the focus, the backdrop of his chapter is I'm with him in Germany at a sold-out concert at, you know, a 20,000-seat arena, and we're there. I'm there all day with him as he sets up, and we're there. I'm literally on stage with him, on stage right in the dark, off to the side at this sold-out show with their guitar tech, and we experience it. But, you know, when he was setting up before the show, one of the few times I saw his face, this is a really unassuming, shy fellow who's just absolutely brilliant, incredibly meticulous and organized with the work he does. He's just an incredible person at what he does. And it's funny, but by and large, his personality is very unassuming. The one time I really saw a lot of animation on his face, not the one time, but one of the few times, was when his phone rang and it was his son calling him. So I think your question or assumption is actually, it's quite the contrary of what I found to be the case.
Yeah, it was something that struck me, not because I sensed that was happening as much as it was hard to sense, because I guess this is what, you know, the issue is. Over the course of the show, I've had on a fair number of people who've talked about issues involving things like attention, right, and the ability of people to maintain attention through a cacophony of information. I've recorded a show this morning, which will air this summer as well, with Victoria Stodden and Julia Lane, who've written about big data and how we try to integrate these enormous data sets into decision making. I've had Dr. Gary Small on a few years ago talking about the human brain and how it's impacted by technology. And what struck me as I was reading the book is that I sense that there is a real yearning, and maybe it's a growing yearning, to be an invisible. In other words, it, I think that there's a real pushback that seems to be happening against social media because there is an increasing recognition that all the glitter of being, having to promote and needing to promote and having to have this public persona, is not achieving the rewards that, that as you write about them, right, in the world that we actually live in. And so, you know, as we're recording the show on July 13th, there's been a, at least a brouhaha within the intellectual property and technology community, which I'm sure you're familiar with, right, involving this Facebook study where a study was done of, you know, close to 700,000 users of Facebook where their news feeds were manipulated, and the problem, among other things, was that Facebook didn't clearly indicate to its users that this was happening. And so you've got this cacophony of social media. And the sense that I have is that there's a yearning to be an invisible in a society that makes it increasingly difficult to do so. So maybe that's probably the better way I should have asked the question. What's your reaction to that?
Yeah, you're really spot on there. It's a great point that, you know, when we return to the example I gave of the editor at one of the publishing houses I met with, who just had this resentment, you know, over the notion that she was supposed to start a Twitter account and stuff. And she said, "I'm an editor. I'm supposed to work behind the scenes." So you are spot on in the notion that there are a lot of people, and I'm sure, and it depends the type of person, because there are a lot of people who just genuinely, I think, have bought into the the culture at large where they are just so actively pursuing attention for themselves. But there also is this really powerful undercurrent and, you know, powerful minority, I think, of us out there who are resentful and anxious about what they feel like the pressure that they're supposed to do. And people just want to kind of, as I say, like step off the wheel. And that, you know, I suspect for probably a lot of the type of people listening to this show, that what the book offers, as you read the examples of these people who are incredibly talented at what they do, and it's just really inspiring seeing the work that they do. You're there with them at their really oftentimes unusual jobs, that it gives you this sort of permission to be like, hey, it's okay. I can step off the wheel. Look at this guy. Look at this woman who's you know, so incredible at what she does, that this notion that there is this pushback, that I think there is a slow but building and growing counter trend to this prevailing culture of noise and of attention. You can think about Susan Cain's book, Quiet, that came out a year or two before mine. You can even look back to another book, Shop Class's Soulcraft, that came out a few years ago, which was a bestseller. There's a growing... Maybe the movement isn't growing, but the people have always been there, but there's a growing acknowledgement that something's a little bit awry here. And what I think my book offers to people who get the sense that something is wrong with what's happening, what my book offers is, I think, a real validation and perhaps a toolkit to explain to themselves or explain to others about why they may feel the way they do and anxious or resentful about not wanting to spend so much time promoting themselves, or maybe they promoting themselves both professionally and personally, that maybe they don't want to share everything about their lives online or elsewhere. So the book really offers, I think, a validation and a toolkit in order to address this, what's going on in the culture, if it feels a bit wrong.
David Zweig, author of the book Invisibles, The Power of Anonymous Work in an Age of Relentless Self-Promotion, published by Penguin. Yeah, you know, David, this is, thanks for being on the show. This is a topic which, is something that has been brought into relief through my own work in the last 8 years doing Hearsay Culture. I mean, the show is designed to be first and foremost a pedagogical device where I am choosing to bring on authors and researchers and technologists and business people and others who I think are doing great work that deserves a wider audience. And I want to create in my way, as much as I can, a wider audience with this work, because I think these ideas and concepts are important. Whether that's called self-promotion, whether it's called recognition, whether it's called pedagogy, I think is a real hard question to answer. But I think in the book, as you pointed out, you've identified what traits are endemic to these people who do this high quality work, and as you just put it, are able to get off the wheel. And so in that sense, and for others, I think it's a valuable contribution to our understanding of the social environment in which we operate, and I thank you for joining us today on the show.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a real delight talking with you.
A pleasure. I'm very excited about the schedule coming up on Hearsay Culture. It's one where we delve into these issues quite a bit. Coming up next week, Professors James Grimmelman of the University of Maryland School of Law and David Post of Temple University on the recent U.S. Supreme Court decision in ABC v. Aereo and on that aforementioned Facebook study. Following that, Professor Fred Schauer, the David and Mary Harrison Distinguished Professor of Law at the University of Virginia and formerly of Harvard's Kennedy School, on the very amorphous right to know. Nabiha Syeda, Levine, Sullivan, Koch, and Schultz, on drone technology and freedom of information. Professor Dave Columbia of Virginia's Commonwealth University, author of The Cultural Logic of Computation. And rounding out the quarter, member of European Parliament Marietti Schaake, on democracy and technology in Europe. As always, you have a number of ways you can listen to Hearsay Culture. You can listen this quarter on KZSU Wednesdays at 2 p.m. Pacific time by going to kzsulive.stanford.edu. You can also get the show via podcast by going to hearsayculture.com, by going to the iTunes page for the Center for Internet Society at Stanford Law School, or by going to the website for the Center for Internet Society at cyberlaw.stanford.edu. As always, I welcome your comments, suggestions, and feedback at dave@hearsayculture.com. And incidentally, by the way, I should mention, a few listeners have emailed me recently saying that Hearsay Culture was not showing up on their favorite podcast or other media aggregator. I would love to know if you'd like to see the show in your favorite podcast or media aggregator. Please email me at dave@hearsayculture.com, and I will do whatever I can to get these private app and other writers to recognize Hearsay Culture and get it on the list. So thank you for listening to the show today. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and have a great day.